evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza on this pre-recorded program via remote from Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Friday, December 18, 2020. UN agencies say communities in South Sudan are facing acute food insecurity.
The food security and nutrition situation has deteriorated. This is because of pockets of insecurity that have led to population displacement.
And a Sudanese national is sentenced to 10 years in prison for raping a minor in South Sudan.
This court is in doubt of that principal perpetrators of such crime deserve a heavy sentence. Convicted person is an imam and a Muslim teacher at Monuki Mosque. He is a well-known person to the victim.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Three United Nations aid agencies are calling for immediate humanitarian access to parts of Pibor County in Jonglei State, where people have run out of food and are facing catastrophic levels of hunger. That's according to a new integrated food security phase classification report released on Friday. The World Food Programme Deputy Country Representative in South Sudan says the report estimates the highest number of people going hungry since 2013. And that an urgent humanitarian response is needed to save lives. For VOA News, Dimo Silva Aurelio reports from Juba.
The Integrated Food Security Pest Classification, or IPC, situation analysis released today indicates an estimated 5.8 million people will likely face IPC Pest 3, which is classified as worst acute food insecurity in South Sudan. The IPC analysis projects that by mid-2021, an estimated 7.2 million people, or 60% of the South Sudanese population, including around 1.4 million children under the age of 5, are expected to be acutely malnourished in 2021, which the UN says is the highest number in 3 years. Isaiah Chol Arwai, chairperson of the National Bureau of Statistics, says several factors have contributed to food insecurity in South Sudan.
The food security and nutrition situation has deteriorated. This is because of pockets of insecurity that have led to population displacement, low crop production because of climatic shocks such as floods and droughts, the ongoing macroeconomic crisis, the effects of the COVID-19 pandemic, pests as desert locusts, and inadequate multi-sectoral humanitarian assistance.
The IPC Global Support Unit released a real-time quality review report indicating that populations in Akobo, Awil South, Tony East, Tony North, and Tony South all fall into the catastrophic IPC Phase 5 acute food insecurity. Arwai is calling for urgent humanitarian intervention.
In order to save lives and avert total collapse of livelihoods in the affected counties, particularly those with populations in catastrophe IPC phase 5 and emergency IPC phase 4, there is urgent need for immediate scale-up of multi-sectoral humanitarian assistance.
The IPC report identified Jonglei, Unity, Upper Nile, Lakes Warrap, and Northern Bahr Ghazal estates as the most affected areas, with 50% of the population facing acute food insecurity. With this new projection, UN agencies working in South Sudan say urgent action is needed to avert the situation from deteriorating further. Makena Walker is the WFP Deputy Country Director in South Sudan.
The World Food Programme joins you in expressing deep concern about this worsening food security and nutrition situation, especially to the people that have been affected by simultaneous shocks. The World Food Programme has already begun scaling up its food and nutrition assistance response. We have extended food assistance beyond the lean season and are increasing the number of people we support.
Walker says WFP has reached 5 million people with food assistance in South Sudan. UNICEF's country representative in South Sudan, Mohamed Ayoya, says 3,000 children are on the verge of severe acute malnutrition.
For us at UNICEF, these are extremely worrying numbers, and we are concerned about the increased numbers of children who are going to suffer, particularly from severe acute malnutrition. As I said, these children are in need for urgent treatments to prevent them from dying. And the data that we have today leave us with no doubts about the sense of urgency for all of us, governments, donor community, and humanitarian actors here in South Sudan, to join hands and ensure that all these children get the treatment they need, and they do so as soon as possible.
UN agencies say the humanitarian appeal for 2020 is underfunded, and more resources are needed to support the humanitarian response in the coming months to strengthen communities and people's capacity to cope with looming famine in South Sudan. For VOA News, I am Dimo Silva Aurelio in Juba.
Still in Juba, a newly launched gender-based violence and juvenile court has sentenced a 60-year-old South Sudanese national, Ahmed Said, to 10 years in prison for raping a 14-year-old girl in Juba. Ahmed is alleged to have sexually abused the girl in April this year when she was cleaning a mosque. The presiding judge in the case says convict of such crimes deserve heavy sentences. For VOA News, Viola Elias reports from Juba.
The Gender-Based Violence Court's presiding judge, Francis Amum, says Said Ahmed Hamid, who is an imam at mosque in the Munuki neighborhood, is supposed to set an example for other citizens in society. Judge Amum says Ahmed's 10-year prison term should send a strong message to people who abuse minors.
This court is in doubt of that principal perpetrators of such crime deserve a heavy sentence. Convicted person is an imam and a Muslim teacher at Monuki Mosque. He is a well-known person to the victim.
Amum says Ahmed was charged under Article 247 of the South Sudan Penal Code 2008, which states that whosoever had sexual intercourse with another person against his or her will is committing rape. He says Ahmed's sentence is appropriate for the crime committed.
Rape and defilement are crime of sexual gender-based violence. They rank among the gravest crime punishable in South Sudan, not exceeding 14 years imprisonment.
Judge Amun says the court listened to Ahmed's lawyer, but his arguments were weak. He says Ahmed must also pay a fine to the victim.
Convicted person is sentenced to 10 years imprisonment with effect from 17 of December 2020, and the convict have to pay for the victim 600,000 South Sudanese pound as remedies through criminal proceeding.
Ahmed's lawyer has a chance to appeal the ruling within 14 days. South Sudan Ministry of Health and the United Nations Population Fund estimates that South Sudan has recorded nearly 7,000 incidents of gender-based violence between January 2010 and September of this year. For VOA News, I am Viola Elias in Juba.
A prominent South Sudanese academician living in the United States says he left his country because the political and security environment was not conducive for his work. Luka Byung Denkwol held a number of academic positions in Sudan and South Sudan before he was forced to leave South Sudan. Kwol was recently appointed Dean of Faculty and Academic Affairs at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies at the U.S. National Defense University. My colleague Nabil Biagio sat down with Kwol to understand why Kwol left South Sudan.
My new role as the Dean of Faculty and Academic Affairs at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies is really to oversee our academic program in terms of the syllabus, in terms of the participants, and the whole of management cycle of any academic program. And we usually engage in executive program, and our focus is on the continent, especially on the security sector. And as you know, our vision as the Africa Center is a security for all Africans. So our programs are tailored in such a way to really, first, to bring a debate towards the security as central for delivery of good governance on the continent. Second, that to enhance the professionalism in the security sector. And third, to bring the debate that the citizen at the center of the delivery of security, not only in Africa, but I think generally.
You were last the director of the Center for Peace and Development at South Sudan's leading university, the University of Juba. Let's revisit the circumstances that made you leave your role there and leave the country.
We created a platform, a series of lectures at the University of Juba for the University of Juba to be engaged on public issues. And one of the series that we brought into the for public discussion, the decision of creating 28 states, because the thing happened at the time, peace agreement was signed, and then we felt that it would be good for the people or the public to know even the rationale of the, you know, the government of creating the 28 states. And it was a very healthy debate in a sense, just to see what are the challenges and opportunities for creating 28 states. I think the government was not comfortable with this arrangement, although they accepted. And the government did not provide a good reason, a good rationale for that decision, especially the legal advisor by then, or even the former chief justice. So it was a showdown to how the public policies had been formulated without any studies. And it was an exposure of the weakness of the government. While the opposition came in very carefully, the Talam came prepared, and they felt as if were exposing the government. So I left the country because the political and security environment was not conducive for me to continue my work.
Listening to your story and seeing where you've ended up now, I think of Africa brain drain, which is, of course, the flight of intellectual capital in terms of scholars, academics, and skilled professionals leaving the continent in search of greener pasture here in the West. Is that how you see your story as well?
The contribution of African academia in producing knowledge is so limited because the environment is not conducive, not only the political environment, but the city environment, but even in terms of the resources. And that's why we saw clearly how the African scholars are not contributing so much because of these appalling conditions of the political implementation of the academic environment. So there's no doubt that the outflow of the academia out of Africa in order to go and look for a better opportunity. In my case, it was a bit different because my desire is to continue in higher institutions. And that's why my first job was in Sudan in the university, and even I went for my scholarship by the University of Al Jazeera with a scholarship from the Belgian government, and I decided to go back because I wanted actually to contribute because I believe there's a lot of things that we can do on the continent. What happened to me was the reverse. I was forced to leave the country.
That's Luca Bionkwal, Dean of Faculty and Academic Affairs at the African Center for Strategic Studies. He was speaking with my colleague Nabil Viajo. Tune in on Monday for the second part of this interview where Kwal discusses the state of higher education in South Sudan. You are listening to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. Coming up, Bodur Airline allows COVID-19 positive passenger on their flight to Juba. Find out why after this break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what do you do when you are in a bad mood?
I usually would move away from the environment of the agitation and then get a quiet place and pray. Usually when I'm done praying, the agitation and the stress, I get some amount of relief.
Sometimes I decide to sleep and maybe read a novel that can make my mind come like back to normal. Yeah, that's what I normally do.
I rather stay alone and I listen to music, uplifting music, music that has good lyrics that would uplift my spirit.
Okay, when I'm in the bad mood, I sometimes play video games just to make me feel happy. Actually, I call mom, I talk to her, tell her what's disturbing me. She advises me, then you sit down there.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. Health officials in South Sudan's capital, Juba, say they have been able to trace most of the passengers who landed in Juba last week on board Bodur Airline plane, which carried a passenger who tested positive for COVID-19 in Sudan. Health officials in Juba say it's proving difficult to trace some of the contacts whose phones were either switched off or were not answered. For VOA News, David Monodanga reports from Juba.
Health Ministry officials are tracing 175 contacts of a woman who traveled to Juba Friday, December 11th, on board Bodur Airline. Officials say she tested positive for COVID-19 in Khartoum, but Sudanese airport authorities still allowed her to board a plane bound for South Sudan. Dr. Angelo Gwobthon, Director for Emergency Preparedness and Response at the Health Ministry, says officials have reached most of the contacts and told them to show up for COVID-19 tests this Friday in Juba. Dr. Gwob says the contacts reached were cooperative, but some people's phones were off and others were not answering, posing a challenge to reach all 175 contacts.
Our team actually reached 90% of these people, and few people were phones were off or not answered. So by next tomorrow, they will start collecting samples from these people. We are very cooperative. There is no any issues.
South Sudan Health Ministry spokesperson Dr. Thor Loy says officials at Juba International Airport deported the Sudanese woman as soon as they realized she tested positive in Khartoum.
The Bodur aircraft that arrived from Khartoum to Juba brought in a person who is positive for COVID-19. Our team at the Juba International Airport detected that, saw her certificate, and she tested positive for COVID-19 at the original destination, that is Khartoum. The international health regulations dictate that we had to send her back, so that particular passenger was sent back to Khartoum.
Dr. Loy says health authorities do not know how such a mistake happened in Khartoum, but insist it's mandatory that all airlines check results of their passengers' COVID-19 test certificates and make sure only those who test negative are allowed to travel to South Sudan.
I would want to be optimistic and assume that it was an oversight by the authorities at the airport in Khartoum. But the bottom line is that we are in touch with this airline and other airlines also, not to actually in the first place allow any positive individuals to board the flight at the destination first to come to South Sudan, because by so doing, even those individuals who are with her or with him are there in the aircraft are already at risk.
Public health regulations require all passengers who traveled with the patient on Bodur Airline on Friday be tested for the coronavirus, said Dr. Loy. Last weekend, Dr. Angelo Gwobthon told journalists authorities will ensure they get hold of all passengers, including those who might have traveled to the States.
We'll might have few people who have might gone to one or other states. We also will link with our counterparts at the state level, the State Minister of Health, and our partners, WHO, to make sure we trace those people. We'll get them and they must be tested because they are contacts.
Sudan Health Ministry spokesperson Babikir Al-Makbul and the secretary of the Sudanese ambassador to South Sudan, Loza Tombe, did not answer repeated calls for comment on this report. Bodur Airlines phones were switched off. Dr. Thorne says it's extremely important for the public to cooperate with health ministry officials collecting samples from the contacts and to observe preventive measures because the world is experiencing a second wave of the pandemic. As of today, South Sudan has 104 active COVID-19 cases, with only one severe case currently at the Dr. John Garang Infectious Disease Unit. For VOA News, I am David Monodanga in Juba.
The World Health Organization's vaccine chief, Dr. Catherine O'Brien, said every country should have access to COVID-19 vaccine as early as possible, but warns that the call for global solidarity has mostly been lost as richer countries buy out vaccine stocks. Now, there are fears desperate countries that are shut out of the COVID-19 vaccine rollout may turn to scientifically unproven alternatives as they face a second wave of the pandemic. VOA's Chinedu Ofo spoke with Kate Elder, Senior Vaccine Policy Advisor for Doctors Without Borders, or MSF, in New York, about the concerns of her group.
Wealthy countries like the European Union bloc, the UK, the United States of America, Canada, they certainly have invested a tremendous sum. I don't want to disregard the tens of billions of dollars that governments, including my own, the government of the United States, I think about $12 billion into Operation Warp Speed and into the development of financing research and development, financing what we call at-risk manufacturing scale-up. So basically paying pharmaceutical companies to start developing manufacturing capacity before they even have approved vaccines, and then also engaging in contracts to secure, you know, tens of millions of doses in advance. They have paid from the public's purse. It is our taxpayer dollars that have paid for this. There are some vaccines like Moderna's vaccine where almost 100% of the research and development has been financed by the public purse. And certainly governments need to get something in return. But what they're getting in return right now is handsome returns in terms of securing doses for their domestic populations, but they're not doing it in a globally minded way. And I think the most important thing is every American citizen, for example, every European citizen should understand that they're truly not safe until everybody in the world is safe. These vaccines are going to be a tremendous help to our public health package of combating COVID-19, for sure. But they're not the panacea. They need to be used in tandem with other public health measures. And everybody around the world who is most vulnerable needs to be protected if anybody is going to be protected. A person sitting here in Brooklyn, where I'm sitting, is vulnerable to coronavirus if somebody in a country in South Sudan, in Niger, is vulnerable, because we are just an interconnected world. You can't isolate yourself. So I hope that citizens of these countries, which are going to benefit from this tremendous public investment, I hope they have that awareness.
Are there fears that some people in these poorer countries, if they are able to get access to COVID vaccines, might turn to some unscientifically unproven cure, making the matter worse?
We're globally connected. People read the news. People in countries which right now are truly at the back of the line and likely won't see COVID-19 vaccines for months, if not possibly years, they're reading what's happening in the news. They're reading that people in the United States are getting these vaccines right now. People in the UK are getting these vaccines. And they're likely frustrated because it's not that they're immune, no pun intended, from coronavirus there. I don't know what people will resort to if they feel like they, you know, don't get access to the leading medical tools. I hope that people use their wherewithal to be able to assess what's truly, you know, a medical intervention and what is an unfounded remedy. I wouldn't want to dismiss people and say that they'll sort of take these unscientifically substantiated measures. I think that's what those people want is they want access to the medical tools that everybody around the world should have. They want access to the medical tools that shouldn't just be a luxury of people sitting in wealthy countries. And I hope that with global collaboration, I hope that with global solidarity, that organizations here in the United States that are fighting for access for people in other countries, organizations in the UK and EU that are fighting for access for people in poor countries, will work collaboratively with people in those countries so that we can, you know, achieve this together.
New reports released this week by two press freedom watchdogs detail a sharp rise in arrests and jailing of journalists around the world, including the United States. For more on the trend, VOA's Jason Patenkin reached out to VOA's press freedom desk editor Jessica Gerard.
Can you first give us an overview of one of these new reports that just came out by the Committee to Protect Journalists? What are the key findings of their report?
So the Committee to Protect Journalists just released its annual census of jailed journalists. The key findings in this report is that it's just the worst year on record. They found 274 journalists jailed in retaliation for their work globally, in part because of the COVID pandemic, but it's also just this increasing authoritarian reaction to critical and independent reporting.
And who are some of the countries that are topping the list? Who are the worst jailers of journalists in the world?
The top three offenders are ones that we see regularly on these lists. You have China, Turkey, Egypt. There are also a couple of new entries on there. Belarus, where there's been crackdowns since the contested re-election of President Alexander Lukashenko. There are 10 journalists still in prison there, still in December. These are people who were arrested between August and November during these big protests. In Ethiopia, which had had this more promising signs of reform for press freedom since the conflict started in Tigray in November, 6 of the 7 journalists who CPJ count on their list are arrested because of their coverage there.
Now, one of the journalists on the list, Ruhollah Zam, an Iranian journalist, he was in jail, but he's now actually dead. He was executed over the weekend. Can you go into what happened with him?
Ruhollah Zam, the really sad fact about this case is that he had fled into exile. He knew he was facing charges for inciting violence during anti-government protests in 2017, and he'd found a new life for himself in France. He traveled to Iraq last year, and Iranian authorities managed to find a way to have him extradited to Iran. He was convicted and hanged on Saturday. The U.S. has responded strongly to that. Secretary of State Pompeo has condemned it as a barbaric execution. But his case exemplifies something that we do see a lot. Journalists flee into exile in Iran and other countries, but the retaliation and the fear and risk that they still face follows them. It's something that VOA's Press Freedom and Extremism Watch desks looked into a couple of months ago. We profiled 14 journalists, 2 of them in Iran, but others in Bangladesh, Pakistan, Kazakhstan, who spoke about what it's like to go into exile, move thousands of miles away, but still know that intelligence agents are still going to knock on your parents' door and demand to know why their son or daughter is still reporting critically and writing anti-government sentiment, just because these journalists, from the safety or the relative safety of being abroad, are trying to still shine a light on some of the corruption and wrongdoing in their home countries.
Now I want to turn to the U.S. There was a second report released this week by the U.S. Press Freedom Tracker, and it looked at arrests and detainings of journalists here in the U.S. What did it find?
Yep. So the Press Freedom Tracker, it just looks at cases in the U.S. And what it found in 2020 is just this unprecedented number of journalists being briefly detained or arrested in the U.S. Between the start of the protests following the death of George Floyd in Minneapolis in May, they've counted 120 cases of journalists being arrested now. They're still verifying new cases, so this figure's just going up and up each day.
That's our show for this Friday. We would like to welcome listeners on Radio Emmanuel 89 FM in Torit Town to the family of VOA affiliate stations across South Sudan. We are glad residents of Torit are now enjoying VOA programs. And I will continue to tell the Monyomiji in Torit that VOA Ongere. We now leave you in a dancing mood with the song Wa by Diamond and Kofi Olomide.
Le général Dangote, le grand
Maneno, tumeazoea. Vijineno, neno, tushazoea. Mpenzi wangu mubaya, kwani naozu, shepu yake mbaya.
We've been listening to Diamond and Kofi Olomide with their latest release entitled Wa. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for allowing us into your phones, vehicles, and homes. Remember to wash your hands with soap, practice social distancing, and wear a mask if you are in public places. Do not escape from COVID-19 quarantine centers because there is no cure for coronavirus. Join us next week for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
Kote, Abutale, Don Mendez, Bajuni, Bajuni.
Chumbani enesi,
unipatia panado wajenga za Messi na mashuti ya Ronaldo yani ndani nikiingia tu anachukua anaweka wa kwenye gari anachukua anaweka iwe jikoni au barandani anachukua